Chapter 24, The Evidence of a Great Fossilization.
He was the most powerful man in the world. In fact, he was actually considered a god. What he said went, and if you dared to disagree, you died.
But one day, two men showed up on his throne, not to listen to his orders, but to give this man an order. This man was to let his slave workers go out and worship the one and only true God. Well, naturally, nobody tells this man what to do, and who in the world do they think they are giving him an order?
Besides, he was the God they needed to worship.
But even more amazing was how the men not only gave him an order, they now proceeded to give him a warning.
This would-be God would be judged if he didn't obey their command.
So the war was on.
The battle of the gods commenced.
The first judgment upon this man was a plague upon his river turning it into blood.
But he still refused to obey.
The second was of a plague of frogs, but he still refused to obey. The third was of a plague of gnats, but still refused to obey.
The fourth was of a plague of flies, but he still refused to obey.
The fifth was of a plague that killed all his livestock, but he still refused to obey. The sixth was of a plague of boils, but he still refused to obey. The seventh was of a plague of hail destroying all his crops, but he still refused to obey. The eighth was of a plague of locusts, but he still refused to obey. And the ninth judgment was of a plague of darkness, but he still refused to obey. And every single one of these judgments was not just an attack on the man's kingdom and his livelihood, but it was a direct attack on all the other false gods that he encouraged the people to worship. But amazingly, with his heart still hardened and his kingdom nearly destroyed, the tenth judgment was pronounced. The firstborn of everyone in his kingdom who worshipped these false gods, including this man who thought he was a god, would die. And sure enough, because of the stubbornness of this one man, the cries rang out, every firstborn child died that very night, including his own son. And it was only then that this stubborn, foolish, prideful man would obey.
He let the people go. The book is Exodus.
The judgment, of course, is the plagues of Egypt.
Now, folks, how many of you have ever heard about the 10 plagues of Egypt? Okay, most of us have, especially if you ever went to Sunday school. It seems to be a popular lesson there. And as we just heard, it really was a time when God Almighty poured out his wrath and judgment on a wicked and rebellious pagan nation, right? And so here's the point. Old Testament, New Testament, it's all over the Bible. The message is clear. God does not mess around with sin, and one day when you least expect it, he's going to judge it. Therefore, here's the point. You would think that people would stand up and take notice when God warns them of this coming judgment, right? I mean, you would think that people would conclude, hey man, I better get right with God so I don't suffer the judgment of God, right? But unfortunately, folks, that's no longer the case. Many people today are not only having a hard time believing in God, but if there's one thing they absolutely refuse to believe in, it is a coming judgment from God. Therefore, in order to help these scoffing people become hopefully smarter people, we're going to continue in our study, The Witness of Creation. And what we've been doing is taking a look at the five different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that he's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with him, the creator of the universe, before it's too late. And so far we've seen the first evidence of this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. The second evidence was the evidence of a young creation. The third evidence was the evidence of a special creation. And in the last chapter we saw the fourth evidence was the evidence of a judged creation. And there we saw there really was a global catastrophe, i.e. a worldwide flood, not just because the Bible says so, but also because the evidences of logic, languages, a lineage, and even of legends say so. Therefore, as we saw, there is no reason to scoff at the biblical account. There's tons of evidence that God judged this world once, and he's getting ready to do it again. And the point is, you better get ready. But that's not all. The second evidence of a judged creation is the evidence of a great fossilization. And the first evidence of a great fossilization is the appearance of sorted layers. One of the first logical discoveries one should expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood is a whole bunch of layered dirt all over the world. And that's because according to the Bible, the flood didn't just last 40 days and 40 nights. If you do the math, you'll see it was over a year. And during that time, while Noah was floating on top, all the dirt on earth got stirred up big time, but eventually, after things including the tides calmed down, the dirt or sediments would start settling on the bottom at various stages. And that's why it's very important to pay attention to every jot and tittle of the scripture, because that's exactly what the text says happened.
Genesis 8:2-3. Now the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed, and the rain had stopped falling from the sky. The water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the water had gone down.
Now folks, according to our text, after the rain had stopped falling from the sky, what did the water do? It receded steadily from the earth, right? Now, here's what's totally amazing. The words there for receded steadily are the two Hebrew words shewb and halak, which literally means to return and to go. So this shows us that when the rain had stopped, the motion of the water did not. Rather, it literally churned back and forth, going and returning for many days to come. This is precisely what you would expect, because now the water is above the highest mountains and there's no resistance to stop the water. In fact, another little nugget declares this. Both words are used in the infinitive absolute form, which means this going and returning was happening over a period of time. If it was only a short one-time event, then the imperfect form would have been used. So now put all the pieces together. The picture we have here is that as Noah was floating on top of the water in the ark, the soil, vegetation, and remains of life forms were churned up, being sloshed around until gradually, layer after layer, of sediments were laid down, one on top of the other. One would be laid down as the water returned that way, another would be laid down as the water went that way. But they wouldn't just settle in layers. They would settle in layers based on density. This is what's known as hydrologic sorting and can be demonstrated this way. Take a clump of dirt and put it into a glass and fill it with water. Then shake it up real good and place it on a table. After a while, what you discover is that the water not only clears up as the dirt settles, but the dirt is now sorted in various layers based on density. The gravel that was in the clump of dirt is now on the bottom, then sand or smaller rocks are on top of that, then the clay, and finally topsoil. This is called hydrologic sorting, and it not only produces this effect in a glass full of water, but it should have produced the same effect if the world was full of water. And so that's the question. Do we find tons of sorted layers based on density all over the world? Of course. It's called sedimentary rock. Notice there's not just a few layers of them, but tons of them. And these kinds of layers are not an isolated event. It is estimated that 80% of the Earth's crust is covered by sedimentary rock that scientists agree was formed by dirt particles being deposited by wind, ice, or water. This is precisely what you'd expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood, tons of dirt layers, now since turned to rock, all over the world. But you might be thinking, dirt turning into rock in a short amount of time? Evolutionists say that these sedimentary layers were deposited and turned to rock over hundreds of millions of years by a slow, gradual process. However, as we saw before, scientists can now not only create rock in the laboratory in a short amount of time with extreme pressure, which would occur in a worldwide flood, but we ourselves create rock in a short amount of time all the time without even thinking about it. It's called concrete. Think about it. What is concrete? Is not just an artificial rock. Do not cement companies crush rock and add some other ingredients to create a chemical reaction and then sell it back to you? And when you get it, what do you add to it to make it harden like a rock? That's right, water. And it forms naturally, easily, and rapidly right before your very eyes. Besides, we've also seen actual sedimentary rock form right before our very eyes in a short amount of time with another cataclysmic event called the eruption of Mount St. Helens. That one rapid event stratified layers up to 400 feet thick as a result of landslides and mudflows. Fine layers from only 1 millimeter thick to more than 3 feet high formed in just a few seconds. In fact, a deposit more than 25 feet thick and containing over 100 thin layers was formed in just one day on June 12, 1980. And gee, I bet if you could find an evolutionist who hadn't a clue about the cataclysmic event called Mount St. Helens and you had them walk through that area, what would they say? These rock layers took millions of years to form over slow, gradual processes, wouldn't they? However, they'd be totally wrong. Thus, could it be possible that the evolutionary explanation of the slow, gradual formation of the sedimentary rock layers that cover 80% of the world are likewise wrong, because they are likewise clues of another cataclysmic event called Noah's flood? And by the way, keep in mind that what we find in these rock layers all over the world is billions and billions of fossilized dead things. Go figure. And speaking of dead things, layering based on density works not only on dirt, but even animals, and may very well explain the positioning and placement of the fossils that we do find in sedimentary rock. First of all, we've already demonstrated that the geological column as a dating method is a bunch of baloney at best, and you can find all kinds of animals and artifacts mixed up throughout the layers. However, it is interesting to note that even what supposed order of animals in layers that the geologists do find, it might very well again have nothing to do with an evolutionary order, but rather a drowning order. For instance, from a global flood perspective, those creatures that already live on the bottom of the ocean like clams and seashells would be buried first, which is generally what we see. Then the slowest moving water creatures and land creatures would be buried next, followed by the faster moving ones, until you end up with things like birds pretty much on top. Why? Not because they evolved last, but because they survived the flood longest. They'd be the last ones to drown because they can fly, and even when they did drown they would float for a while because their bones are hollow. In fact, an experiment was done at Loma Linda University, where they took a dead bird, mammal, reptile, and amphibian and placed them in a tank full of water. They floated for several days, but each eventually sank to the bottom based on the buildup and leakage of gases from their decaying bodies, the absorption or loss of water by their bodies, and of course density. The order in which they settled was as such: from the bottom up, amphibian, reptile, mammal, and finally bird. Notice how this order closely resembles the supposed evolutionary order, yet evolution had nothing to do with it. A natural drowning order based on density did. Exactly what you'd expect to see if there really was indeed a worldwide flood like the Bible states. And speaking of layers, only the flood of Noah could sufficiently explain some of the other different types of sedimentary layer we observe, such as simple lamination, cross-lamination, ripple lamination, and even graded lamination, as this researcher reveals.
While geologists have noted each type for more than 100 years, the conditions which are responsible for depositing each is far from adequately understood. In many cases, normal, everyday processes are inadequate to produce the observed stratification, and some type of catastrophic or semi-catastrophic geologic mechanism is required. It is noteworthy that the flood in many cases could adequately explain these types of stratification. Simple lamination and bedding is the most common type of stratification, yet one of the least well understood. Alan V. Jopling of the University of Ontario has suggested that simple lamination and bedding were deposited very rapidly. It is probable, however, that the rate of deposition is of the same order of magnitude as cited previously: seconds, minutes, and possibly hours. Cross-lamination and cross-bedding are produced by wind or flowing water. Jopling suggests that water deposited cross-laminae which are 1/8 to 1/4 inch thick should form in a period of a few seconds. He calculates that single cross-beds form in the Mississippi River in a period of less than 1 minute. At these very rapid rates of deposition, Jopling suggests that cross-bedded deposits over 30 feet thick may have accumulated in only a few days. Probably the most conclusive evidence that stratification can be produced by flood conditions comes from ripple lamination.
Ripple lamination is common in sedimentary rocks. Often what is a massive and apparently structureless rock to the eye shows ripple lamination in X-ray photographs. The chief significance of ripple lamination is that sediment must have been introduced in abundance over a wide area with a strong water current.
Ordinary stream conditions do not feed sand over a wide enough area to produce the lamination.
Flood conditions, however, are ideal for the formation of ripple lamination. The term graded bedding refers to a type of stratification where each stratum displays a progressive decrease in the coarseness of grains from the base to the top. The base of each bed may range from fine sand to coarse gravel. The top of each bed usually contains fine silt and clay with an absence of coarser material. The individual beds range from a few tenths of an inch to several feet thick, and they may build up great thicknesses of rock, even thousands of feet, characterized throughout by a monotonous repetition of coarse and fine materials, with the gradation always in the same sense. The beds are generally even, commonly remarkably so, and individual beds appear to have extraordinary lateral extent, locally even miles. A reasonable explanation of graded bedding in terms of the standard processes of stream or shallow water deposition has proved difficult. The facts seem to demand that material be dumped suddenly yet fairly evenly over a large area and then allowed to settle quietly in accordance with size, coarser before finer, undisturbed by scouring currents, and that the dumping be endlessly repeated though separated by intervals of complete quiet. What does all the talk by geologists about turbidity currents mean? Basically, it is a subtle admission that every day, conventional processes of nature are not satisfactory to explain large portions of the stratigraphic record. Geologists are acknowledging that spasmodic and semi-catastrophic events are important geologic processes. Turbidity currents have certainly deposited a graded bed several feet thick in only a few hours. Since thousands of feet of strata are composed of graded bedding, the rate of deposition must have been very rapid.
Obviously, the theoretical average rate of sedimentation, 1 foot every 2,000 years, which is based on uniformitarian assumptions, is here greatly in error. Also, a single turbidity current deposits sediment over areas of many thousands of square miles.
The monotonous repetition of graded bedding indicates that turbidity currents frequently recurred. They must have been of major geologic and global significance. It is noteworthy that the flood would have generated turbidity currents as well as conditions very similar to turbidity currents. The waters of the flood would have stirred up a heavy and viscous load of sediment. When the turbidity of the waters decreased, very rapid deposition would have occurred over vast areas.
Minor oscillations in current would have introduced new sediment which could have been deposited on previous beds, producing the characteristic repeating graded beds.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say that evidence from sorted layers is not just interesting, but I'd say gee whiz, it sure seems to indicate that a worldwide flood really did create all the great fossilization we see today. How about you? In fact, I'd say you'd have to be willingly ignorant to think otherwise, you know what I'm saying? Oh, but that's not all. The second evidence of a great fossilization is the appearance of sudden death and burial. Another logical discovery one should expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood is not only a world full of layered mud, but a world full of fossils or dead things in that mud, right? And folks, what you need to understand is that it's not just the Bible that records for us the record of a single global catastrophic event that destroyed virtually all life on the planet in the past, but even a recent issue of Science magazine admits it. They admit that a single cataclysmic event rather than a series of catastrophes led to mass extinction of the vast majority of life on Earth in the ancient past. In fact, they consider it to be the largest mass extinction in the history of Earth. Now here's the point. Notice this cataclysmic event happened suddenly, not gradually over millions of years. And as we saw before, this is precisely what is needed for something to fossilize. Contrary to popular belief, it does not take millions of years for something to fossilize. Rather, it can and does happen quickly with the right conditions, sudden death, sudden burial, and great pressure. In fact, any other manner of death than that and a carcass would be picked apart and scavenged, leaving behind no remains, let alone a fossil. If it floated on the water, then it would be picked apart. If it laid on the wide open ground, it would be picked apart. In order to explain the fossils we do see, we have to have an event that provided the right circumstances, sudden death, sudden burial, and great pressure. But not only that, this event has to be global because we not only find fossils, but billions of them, and they're not just in one locale, but they're everywhere. And folks, if I didn't know better, why I'd say a worldwide flood foots the bill, how about you? I mean, think about it. It would do all three at the same time, on a global scale, right? Sudden death, sudden burial, and great pressure. You'd have a wall of water destroying and burying billions of things in mud all over the world. Gee, go figure. And so that's the question. Do we see billions of dead things buried in mud all over the world? Slightly. But remember, it has to happen rapidly. Sudden death, sudden burial. Do we see any evidence of that? Of course. Let's take a look.
Number 1. They've actually found a fossil of not just a fish, but a fossil of a fish swallowing a fish. That didn't fossilize over millions of years, and it sure didn't float around somehow avoiding being picked apart by other fish. Rather, common sense tells us that it had to happen rapidly. In fact, so rapidly that it died and was preserved in sediment in mid-bite. And this isn't the only one they've discovered like this in the world. There are thousands of such finds, exactly what you'd expect to find if there really was indeed a worldwide flood. Number 2. Another fossil discovered was a 14-foot-long fish with a smaller fish inside its stomach, possibly as the big fish's breakfast. Common sense tells us that since the digestion process is rapid, then this fossilization must have happened even more rapid. Just like you'd expect to find if there really was indeed a worldwide flood. Number 3. In fact, talk about rapid. They've even discovered a fossil of a pregnant ichthyosaur giving birth. Now I know some pregnancies can seem like it's taking a million years, but obviously this one never made it to the finish line. It died and was fossilized in mid-birth. Exactly what you'd expect to find if there really was indeed a worldwide flood. Number 4. Oh, but it's not just fish. Even animals get in on the act. They've actually found the fossilized remains of two fighting dinosaurs, who obviously died very suddenly while still fighting. A velociraptor has embedded its deadly foot claw into the neck of the crouching Protoceratops. In turn, the Protoceratops appears to have bitten and broken the right arm of the velociraptor, whose left hand grips the head of the Protoceratops. Did these guys decide to strike this pose for millions of years, while somehow avoiding being eaten until they were fossilized? Or does common sense tell us that they obviously died, and were fossilized in mid-swing, so to speak? Again, exactly what you'd expect to find if there really was indeed a worldwide flood. Number 5. Oh, but fish and animals aren't the only ones we see experiencing rapid death and burial. So do plants. They've come across ferns that were fossilized before they even had time to wilt. Question: how long does it take a fern to wilt? An hour? 12 hours? A day? A week? Certainly not thousands or millions of years. Thus, common sense tells that this must have happened very rapidly. Just like you'd expect to see if a worldwide flood did indeed happen. Number 6. And speaking of amazing, they've even found fossilized jellyfish. Now, last time I checked, the anatomy of a jellyfish doesn't have a long shelf life. It's called jelly for a reason. Even if they could avoid being scavenged, in just a matter of hours, they would have turned into unrecognizable blobs. Question: how could we have fossilized jellyfish if it really took millions of years? Doesn't common sense tell us that something had to bury them very rapidly, very suddenly under great pressure? I'm thinking S worldwide flood foots the bill again. How about you? In fact, the evolutionist who discovered the Ediacara jellyfish said the fossils must have formed in less than 24 hours. And he didn't mean just one jellyfish in 24 hours, he meant the millions of jellyfish and other forms that had fossilized throughout the entire Ediacara formation, which stretches about 300 miles from South Australia into the Northern Territory, in less than 24 hours. Number 7. And speaking of bottom-dwelling creatures, they've also discovered some trilobite tracks preserved in stone. Question: not just the trilobites, but how did the trilobites' tracks manage to not get erased before they became fossilized if it really takes millions of years to form out of mud? Number 8. And speaking of tracks, trilobites aren't the only ones we find. We find tons and tons of various animal tracks, and even raindrop marks perfectly fossilized that common sense tells us could never have happened unless something buried them rapidly, just like you'd expect to find in a worldwide flood. Number 9. In fact, so suddenly that we even find delicate structures, such as dragonfly wings, which were buried quickly enough to imprint themselves in mud before the decay made that impossible. Now that's a fast burial.
And speaking of common sense, until Darwin's theory came along, most educated laymen and scientists, including the founding fathers of geology, assumed that fossils were the remains of plants and animals buried in Noah's flood. Or as one researcher puts it,
if there really was a great flood, you would expect the fossil record to reveal billions of dead things, buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth. And what we do find in the fossil record is, billions of dead things, buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth. What do you know?
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say that evidence from sudden death and burial is not just interesting, but I'd say gee whiz, it sure seems to indicate that a worldwide flood really did create all the great fossilization we see today. How about you? In fact, I'd say you'd have to be willingly ignorant to think otherwise, you know what I'm saying? Oh, but that's not all. The third evidence of a great fossilization is the appearance of swirling graveyards. Another logical discovery one should expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood is not only a world full of layered mud full of dead things, but you need tons of dead things.
Genesis 7:20-23. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 20 feet. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished: birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out: men and animals and the creatures that move along the ground, and the birds of the air were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those with him in the ark.
Now folks, according to our text, the Bible clearly states that not just a few things died here and there, but what? Tons of creatures died everywhere. And so that's the question. Do we not only see evidence of layered mud and some dead things in that mud, but do we see tons of dead things in that mud? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. First of all, these tons of dead things are so commonplace around the world they have a name for them. They're called dinosaur graveyards. And they not only contain tons of fossils, as opposed to one scattered here and there, but they find them all jumbled up, thrown together in a disorderly mass, which is exactly what you would expect to find if there was a worldwide flood like the Bible states. This is because of two things. One, because since animals like to travel in packs or herds, when a sudden wave overtook them, not just one, but a whole mess of animals would be preserved in mud. But they wouldn't necessarily be preserved all nice and neat, lying in a flat orderly rows in an orderly manner. Rather, the swiftness and violence of the waves would have left them in a twisted, contorted, swirling mass, if you will. Also, to make things even more messy, some of the animals would have quickly buried while others would have floated. Those that floated would eventually rot. As they rotted, they'd start to fall apart with various limbs dropping off. So now, you have a swirling mass of animals and pieces of animals floating in the water, but eventually when the waters receded, this mass of tangled up carcasses and carcass parts would also be encased in mud. So either scenario shows us that if there really was a worldwide flood, we should find a whole mess of bones all over the world in a mixed up mess. And so that's the question. Do we see any evidence of this? Slightly. Let's take a look. Again, they're called dinosaur graveyards and they totally support the biblical account of Noah's flood. One researcher states,
"At this spot, in Wyoming, the fossil hunters found a hillside literally covered with large fragments of dinosaur bones. In short, it was a veritable mine of dinosaur bones. The concentration of the fossils was remarkable. They were piled in like logs in a jam."
Wow. Logs in a jam are what you'd expect to find in a biblical flood. In fact, there are so many animals jam-packed in these graveyards that they're oftentimes 2 to 3 miles thick of bones. Which explains why hordes of large animals are entombed in a thick rock layer, such as the dinosaurs preserved along the Red Deer River in Alberta, Canada, and why dinosaur bones have been excavated by the tons in the fossil graveyards found in Vernal, Utah. In fact, in one site alone, the Karo Beds in Africa, there are an estimated 800 billion remains, and even after decades of fossil collecting, bones are still sticking out of the ground and stretch for hundreds of miles. And remember the herd effect as mentioned above. Well, this also explains why there are so many strictly hippopotamus bones in places like Sicily that they dig them out with bulldozers and use them to make charcoal. That's a big herd. It also explains the 10,000 hadrosaurs that were found on Egg Mountain alone, all jumbled together in what appears to have been a mass death. How could this ever happen to this size of a herd under slow, gradual processes as evolution would have us believe? To illustrate this point, let's look at another herd. Millions of buffalo were slaughtered on the North American plains during about 150 years ago, and so this means if evolutionary processes were true, we should find tons of buffalo graveyards all over the place, right? Of course. But the problem is we don't. Why? Because their remains disappeared before they could fossilize from decomposition, weather, or even scavengers. So why is it we do find massive fossilized dinosaur graveyards with millions of remains in giant heaps along with piles of millions of mammals, fish, insects, plants, etc.? Could it be that they all died together suddenly in some massive sudden catastrophe? Gee, I wonder what that was? Also, just like you'd expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood, these bones are all jumbled up with not just one kind of animal but various kinds of animals, including various pieces of various animals. Pictures of these dinosaur graveyards often show people chiseling out a backbone or something of an animal that has no legs, head, tail, or rib cage attached to it with no teeth marks on the bone, and next to it is another backbone of another animal all bent and twisted. This shows us that these animals weren't torn apart by scavengers. Rather, this is a case of animals rotting apart, as mentioned above, during the flood. Or as one person states, we have huge, mass graves where dinosaur fossils are jumbled together like so much flotsam after a flood. Gee, I wonder which flood that was? And just like you'd expect to find in a worldwide flood, these dinosaur graveyards are also worldwide. There's the Morrison Beds in North America, the Dinosaur Beds in Montana, in the Rocky Mountains, in Alberta, the Dakotas, China, Colorado, Utah, Africa, etc., etc., all of which contain millions of dinosaur fossils all piled together in tremendous heaps. In fact, The following are some excerpts from various articles revealing not only the massive amount of dinosaur graveyards around the world, but the multitude of mixed-up kinds of animals they contain, some of which that are from various parts of the world.
Florida. A new bone bed has been discovered south of Tampa. Paleontologists say it is one of the richest fossil deposits ever found in the United States. It has yielded the bones of more than 70 species of animals, birds, and aquatic creatures. About 80% of the bones belong to plains animals, such as camels, horses, mammoths, etc. Bears, wolves, large cats, and a bird with an estimated 30-foot wingspan are also represented. Mixed in with all the land animals are sharks' teeth, turtle shells, and the bones of fresh and saltwater fish. The bones are all smashed and jumbled together, as if by some catastrophe. The big question is how bones from such different ecological niches, plains, forests, ocean, came together in the same place.
Malta. On the island of Malta there are lions, tigers, mammoths, birds, beavers, hippopotamus, and foxes all mixed together. A cave in Malta contains so many fossils that Malta's present size would not keep this awesome quantity alive for just 1 week.
Siberia. The pinnacle of the great fossil graveyards must be that of the Arctic and Siberia. It is on a scale so awesome and stupendous that they utterly defy description. Buried in the frozen tundra are countless mammoths, elephants, horses, lions, foxes, camels, and other species. For mammoths alone, estimates have run as high as 5 million in these titanic graveyards. Some of these fossils were so well preserved that their flesh was used to feed husky dogs. How did they get there in such huge quantities? Mammoth remains occur further inland as well as marine shells. In the same layers were found the bones of elephants and many other animals. The researcher added, "This undoubtedly has come from a great inundation." There were also several remains of both elephants and buffaloes and heads of great fishes.
California. In California, petrified fish, fossilized with mouths open, backs arched and fins spread, have been found. Many of these fish are partly on end with the body passing through two planes of rock strata. By modern geology, this would mean that the fish tail is separated from its head by millions of years. That, of course, is not possible. There are approximately 5 fish per square foot over approximately 4 square miles. This equates to more than 1 billion fossilized fish over an area of 4 square miles.
England. In Fifeshire, England, well-preserved fish were found in sandstone. More than 1,000 fish were jammed into one square yard. How did they get there? Modern geology cannot explain fossil graveyards, and many geologists admit to this. These graveyards are dramatic evidence that an era of the world ended with enormous violence.
Nebraska. In Sioux County, Nebraska, on the south side of the Niobrara River, in Agate Springs Quarry, is a fossil-bearing deposit. The state of the bones indicate a long and violent transportation before they reached their final resting place. The fossils are in such remarkable profusion, in places, as to form a veritable pavement of interlacing bones, very few of which are in their natural articulation with one another. One sample contains about 100 bones to the square foot. There is no way of explaining an aggregation of fossils as a natural death retreat of animals of various genera. A few miles to the east, in another quarry were found skeletons of an animal, which is called a gazelle camel, Stenomalus. A herd of these animals was destroyed in a disaster. The transportation was in a violent cataract of water, sand, and gravel that left marks on the bones. Tens of thousands of animals were carried over an unknown distance, then smashed into a common grave.
Pennsylvania. Sir Henry H. Horworth presented evidence that a tremendous flood had flowed over the North American continent. He discussed Hartman's Cave in Pennsylvania, whose contents were described by a Professor Leidy. Both extinct animals and human artifacts were found, one of which was a remarkable relic. A cone shell bored through the axis as a bead. The shell was a marine species, Conus torquatus, found on the western coast of Central America. How does a marine shell from Central America find its way north to a cave in Pennsylvania with Ice Age fauna? Trade routes at this time are out of the question, but an oceanic tidal wave would carry such a shell northward.
North Carolina. Great beds of oyster shells have been discovered along with fossil bones of elephants and mammoth remains.
Cuba. In Cuba, the remains of a giant sloth, giant extinct rodents, a crocodile, and a tortoise, Testudo cubensis, were found together with the relic of a mastodon. The fact that marine and terrestrial animals were buried in the same soils and sediment level where human bones or artifacts have been found suggests that an immense, recent flood occurred.
Arctic. At Port Kennedy, Mr. Walker found marine shells of the present period at a height of 557 feet above the sea. A bone of a whale lay at a height of 164 feet.
Michigan. Two whale skeletons had been discovered in Michigan bogs, which covered glacial deposits. Whales are marine animals. How did they come to Michigan in the post-glacial epoch? Whales do not travel by land. Glaciers do not carry whales, and the ice sheet would not have brought them to the middle of a continent. Bones of a whale have been found 440 feet above sea level, north of Lake Ontario. A skeleton of another whale was discovered in Vermont, more than 500 feet above sea level, and still another in the Montreal, Quebec area, at about 600 feet above sea level.
Alabama. A species of tertiary whale, Zeuglodon, left its bones in great numbers in Alabama and other Gulf states. The bones of these creatures covered the fields in such abundance, and were so much of a nuisance on the top of the ground that the farmers piled them up to make fences.
Georgia. In Georgia, marine deposits occur at altitudes of 160 feet and, in northern Florida, at altitudes of at least 240 feet. Walrus are found in Georgia deposits.
Belgium. The number of whales at Antwerp was so great that this discovery affirms that an immense flood hit the English Channel and concurs with that of the Midwestern United States, where large numbers of whale remains were left in the wake of floods.
Denmark. The skeleton of a prehistoric whale has been discovered 24 miles inland from the North Sea coast, embedded 6 feet down in a bog of North Schleswig. Experts of the Institute of Geological Research at Copenhagen have taken charge of the excavations of the skeleton, hoping to find an answer to the puzzle of how the giant sea mammal got so far from the sea.
Norway. In Vestspitsbergen, Norway, a whale was discovered in the permafrost, a physical impossibility based on geological uniformitarianism. Lamont discovered whale bones and driftwood several miles inland from the Spitsbergen Islands, north of Norway, and, high above the high water mark, skeletons of whales 30 to 40 feet above the sea level.
South America. Whale fossils that were found at or near the surface of the Andes Mountains in South America caused surprise in the scientific community. As reported in the New York Times, scientists have found fossil whales and other marine animals in mountain sediments in the Andes. Oyster shell beds like those found all across the southern part of the United States are also found in South America.
Australia. Whale and dolphin remains have been found in many places, notably in the Grangeburn area, near Hamilton, and at Beaumaris, near Melbourne. Also, teeth and ear bones of extinct sperm whales are very common.
Furthermore, what's really interesting is these messed up, jumbled up pieces of fossils are also found going through two or more layers of sedimentary rock, which shows us that this didn't happen over millions of years as evolutionists would say, but rather quite suddenly. Much akin to the evidence we saw previously about the trees or what's called palustrata fossils going through several layers. In short, only a biblical flood that covered the whole world can fully explain the evidence of dinosaur graveyards we find all over the world. Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say that evidence from swirling graveyards is not just interesting, but I'd say gee whiz, it sure seems to indicate that a worldwide flood really did create all the great fossilization we see today. How about you? In fact, I'd say you'd have to be willingly ignorant to think otherwise, you know what I'm saying? Oh, but that's not all. The fourth evidence of a great fossilization is the appearance of supersized coal. Another logical discovery one should expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood is not only a world full of layered mud full of tons of dead things, that is animals, but you need tons of dead things including plants, right? What did the text say earlier? The waters rose even above the mountains, which meant it would not have only destroyed tons of animal life, but tons of plant life, right? And so that's the question. Do we see any evidence of tons of destroyed plant life scattered all over the world? Slightly. Let's take a look. First of all, the evidence of scattered plant life is called forest beds. And this is the name given to massive amounts of tree remains all broken up in huge quantities, entangled and intertwined with other tree remains in parts of the world where these trees are not normally found. This has led to the obvious conclusion that these literal forests of trees have drifted to their present location. Also, their roots do not end in small fibers but are broken off anywhere from 1 to 3 feet from the trunk. It would appear that they were violently ripped from their original location and deposited in their new location. Furthermore, oftentimes these massive mixed-up forest beds also contain the remains of a mixture of animals. For instance, in one forest bed in England they discovered bones of different kinds of animals that live in different kinds of locations all mixed up in one location. There were bones of birds, frogs, snakes, saber-toothed tiger, bear, mammoth, elephant, hippopotamus, rhinoceros, bison, just to name a few. When's the last time you saw a hippopotamus roaming around in England? In fact, two of the animal remains were a glutton or wolverine and a muskox, which are northern species. Yet, they were found buried with the remains of animals that normally live in tropical climates like the elephant and rhinoceros. And what's even more wild is that just above the forest bed, they discovered plants from the Arctic willow and dwarf birch. As one researcher rightly questioned.
What could have brought together, or in quick succession, all these animals and plants from the tundra of the Arctic Circle and from jungles of the tropics, from lush oak forest and from desert, from lands of many latitudes and altitudes, from freshwater lakes and rivers, and from salt seas of the north and south?
Their conclusion? They propose that there must have been an immense tidal flood. Gee, I wonder which flood that would be. And speaking of mixed up plants in mixed up places, these instances can be found all over the world. For instance, near Clarkia, Idaho, they've discovered an abundant supply of fossilized subtropical plants. In Wyoming there are fossilized palm leaves where today one only finds sagebrush and grassland. In Alaska they have found subtropical species such as the magnolia and figure in the western United States where today we only see grassland, shrub, or desert vegetation, there are many fossil beds that contain temperate, subtropical and even tropical plants. In fact, large fossilized trees are found near the North and South Poles. And in Antarctica, some trees are 24 feet long and 2 feet thick. Gee, that's kind of what one would expect to see if there really was a worldwide flood. Plants mixed up all over the place, all over the world. Go figure. Oh, but that's not all. We should not only find plants mixed up all over the world, we should find a massive amount of plants buried all over the world. Remember, all the plant life was destroyed in the flood. So do we find huge deposits of dead plant life all over the world? Of course. It's called coal. Now the problem is, evolutionists would try to say that coal is formed when plants are collected together over millions of years in freshwater swamps or peat bogs and eventually turns into coal. However, we know this cannot be true for several reasons. For instance, in many locations we know the coal formed very rapidly and not over millions of years because we find tree trunks, some taller than 10 feet, sticking straight up in the coal seams or even at an angle, which tells us they didn't have time to rot. Also, some trees are found upside down in the coal seams, which shows us they did not grow in place as the evolutionary explanation would assume. Furthermore, as stated above, evolutionists say coal was formed in freshwater swamps or peat bogs, yet the problem is we find saltwater marine organisms within the coal. One such saltwater organism is a small marine tube worm called the Spirorbis, which is not only abundant, but no member of this genus is found in a freshwater habitat. In fact, we also find such things as coal balls, which are rounded masses of plant or animal fossils. Among other things, inside these coal balls are often found saltwater marine animals including sponges, corals, and mollusks. And finally, sometimes we find massive boulders inside the coal as well. For instance, in West Virginia many such boulders have been found. The only problem is, most of the boulders are unlike rocks known to occur in West Virginia. The nearest possible source for some of the rocks is 60 miles away. So the question is, how did these saltwater creatures make it into a freshwater swamp and how did boulders travel 60 miles and conveniently drop in a peat bog if the typical evolutionary explanation for the origin of coal is correct? Or, could it be, there's another accurate explanation that fits all the facts? Can you say worldwide flood? As it turns out, a geologist named Dr. Stephen Austin became unsatisfied with the typical evolutionary answer for the formation of coal for reasons we've just seen. Their explanation just doesn't fit the facts. So he began to study a coal field in Kentucky and, based upon the data he was seeing, came up with what's called the floating mat model for the formation of coal. And what he proposed, based on the evidence, is that a giant watery catastrophe must have stripped away millions of acres of forest and then tangled them into mats. Then these massive mats of plants floated on an ocean over the now Kentucky area. As they did, they continuously bumped into each other, which made their bark drop off and sink to the bottom. Following this, the remains were subjected to heat and pressure and were quickly transformed into coal. First of all, this sounds exactly like what you would expect if there really was a worldwide flood. Secondly, as we've already seen in our lifetime, a catastrophe called Mount St. Helens that created a huge log mat when it blew millions of trees into Spirit Lake. As the massive log mat floated and bumped into each other in the water, the bark of the trees fell off and sunk to the bottom, which is now several feet deep along with other vegetation. In fact, the whole bottom of the lake is covered with it. Also, when they used sonar to map the bottom of the lake, they not only found thousands of the logs now lying on the bottom, but many of them sunk and landed in the upright position and remained there while sediment continues to fill in around them. Gee, that sounds like what we find in coal seam today, trees in the upright position. And finally, if we could apply the right heat and pressure, all the material at the bottom of Spirit Lake would quickly change to coal. So how could the conditions of the worldwide flood create enough heat and pressure to transform these massive plants' remains from massive log mats into coal? Well, many believe that you would have sufficient heat and pressure from the massive amount of water covering the material. Remember, the water rose 20 feet above the mountains. This would create an enormous pressure. Secondly, as the planet was subjected to this intense pressure and upheaval, you would invariably have a high amount of volcanic activity all over the world, which would supply the sufficient heat. In short, the massive heat and pressure created by the flood would rapidly transform the massive vegetative remains from the flood into the coal that we have today. This is not only biblical, it's totally consistent with the facts we see concerning coal, much more so than the typical evolutionary response. But you might be thinking, can coal really be created in a short amount of time? Of course. In fact, there's all kinds of things that evolutionists say takes millions of years to form, yet they can actually be created in a short amount of time. We already saw this with things such as fossils and stalagmites and stalactites. But that's the tip of the iceberg. If you recall, we also mentioned how folks from Canada can not only turn sewage into oil using heat, but they can do so in about 30 minutes. And recently British scientists have invented a way to turn household garbage into oil in just 10 minutes. And not so surprising, they can do the same thing with coal, as George Hill, Dean of College of Mines and Mineral Industries, admitted.
A rather startling and serendipitous discovery resulted. These observations suggest that in their formation, high-rank coals were probably subjected to high temperature at some stage in their history. A possible mechanism for formation of these high-rank coals could have been a short-time, rapid heating event.
In fact, here's an instance where we've actually seen recently formed coal occur. This article states,
"A very remarkable observation was made during the construction of a railway bridge at Alt-Breisach, near Freiburg. The wooden piles which had been rammed into the ground were compressed by overriding blocks. An examination of these compressed piles showed that in the center of the compressed piles was a black, coal-like substance. In continuous succession from center to surface was blackened, dark brown, light brown, and finally yellow-colored wood. The coal-like substance corresponded, in its chemical composition, to anthracite, hard coal, and the blackened wood resembled brown coal. From all available evidence, it would appear that coal may form in a very short time, geologically speaking, if conditions are favorable."
And finally, if there really was a worldwide flood, then one would not only expect to find in these giant log mats now transformed into coal a few plants and animals here and there, but tons of them, right? Well, gee, that's precisely what we find. Here's just one article showing how entire forests have been discovered in coal mines.
"A carboniferous forest extending some 4 square miles has been found in the ceiling of a coal mine. About 50 species have been identified, including ferns and horsetails over 10 times taller than those alive today. The forest also contains some mangrove-like plants and is one of the world's oldest tropical rainforests, preserved 250 feet below the surface. Plant fossils are common in coal beds. Coal, after all, is the compacted result of plant materials. But scientists are surprised by the size of this fossil bed, which they suspect came about because of a freak, fortuitous event, an earthquake that flooded and buried the forest.
In the past decade, as miners excavated room after room, they began to notice the imprints of leaves, logs and stumps in the ceiling. Some stumps were 5 feet in diameter, and one log was more than 100 feet long. These are the remnants of extinct plants. So the plants would seem bizarre to modern eyes, said study co-author Howard Falcon Lang, a geologist at the University of Bristol in the United Kingdom. These are some of the earliest known rainforests on our planet, he said. It was like something out of Jules Verne. What's extraordinary about this discovery is that this forest has been preserved in its growth position, said Falcon Lang. It's an upright forest with trees still standing upright. As mining continues, the size of the exposed fossil forest grows by the day.
Oh, and keep in mind that we not only find these coal seams and deposits all over the world, but some of them can be traced over 100,000 square miles. Now, that's a lot of plants. Exactly what you'd expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood. And apparently, that's why one person stated this.
Nowhere on Earth today do we have fossils forming on the scale that we see in geologic deposits. The Karoo beds in Africa, for example, contain the remains of perhaps 800 billion vertebrates. But such fossils are not forming today. 1 million fish can be killed in red tides in the Gulf of Mexico, but they simply decay away. They do not become fossils. Similarly, debris from vegetation do not today become coal. In order for that to occur, the vegetation would have to be rapidly buried under a heavy load of sediment. It required massive flood conditions to do all that burying. An immense worldwide catastrophe occurred in the past. It produced the Sicilian hippopotamus beds, the fossils of which are so extensive that they are mined as a source of charcoal, the great mammal beds of the Rockies, the dinosaur beds of the Black Hills and the Rockies, as well as in the Gobi Desert, the fish beds of the Scottish Devonian stratum, the Baltic amber beds, Agate Spring Quarry in Nebraska, and hundreds more. None of this fossil making is being done today. It only happened one time in history at the time of the flood.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say that evidence from supersized coal is not just interesting, but I'd say gee whiz, it sure seems to indicate that a worldwide flood really did create all the great fossilization we see today. How about you? In fact, I'd say you'd have to be willingly ignorant to think otherwise, you know what I'm saying? Therefore, I'd say based on the evidence we just saw, there's no reason to scoff at the idea that God already judged his creation with a worldwide flood. How about you? In fact, I'd say if you persist, then I'd say you're not only willingly ignorant, but neither are you prepared for the second judgment of God that's coming sooner than you might think. Maybe you should stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ before it's too late. Isn't that what a smart person would do, right? I think so. But that's right, if you don't want to take my word for it, then please, I beg you, listen to God's.
Jude 5 and 7. Though you already know all this, I want to remind you that the Lord delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who did not believe. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire.
Oh people, I beg you, please don't be like the unbelievers who came out of Egypt. According to the word of God, because they refused to believe and obey the words of God, they what? They showed that they really didn't belong to God and thus were destroyed along the way. And so I ask you, where are they today? They're gone. They've now become an example to those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire, of God's judgment. Why? Because they refused to believe in what God said he was going to do. If only they would have taken him at his word. If only they would have gotten saved before it was too late. And so I ask you, what's it going to take for you to stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ, before it's too late? As you saw in this study, God's been merciful. He's given us the evidence of a great fossilization to show us he judged the world once, he's going to do it again. And therefore, I beg you, like Noah did with the people of his day, please, please, won't you turn from your wicked ways? Won't you get right with God? Won't you escape the wrath to come? Won't you come into the ark? Please, this is not a game. Time is running out. The rain is going to be here before you know it, but then it'll be too late. Please, won't you accept God's offer to get saved before it's too late? And yet the Bible says that because the people of that day refused to listen to Noah, they all likewise perished. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. How about you? Are you ready? Or will you likewise perish?